pulled from, you know, it's about 500 voices from the Manhattan Project and all sides of the World War II, including the so-called Hibakusa, the bomb-affected people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it's pulled from about 100 memoirs, a half dozen large-scale oral history projects by places like Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and then, you know, actually a lot of Nobel Prize lectures for this one. J. Robert Oppenheimer's 1,000-page transcript of his Atomic Energy Commission security hearing was a really useful primary source. And I sit down at the sort of start of the writing process, which is really a deleting process, with a document that is about 1.4 million words. And it's about 4,000 pages.
And the average long book is 200,000 words.
And then spend months just deleting and boiling away between 90 and 95% of that to get down to sort of the finished final golden syrup.
But I imagine, to use another metaphor, I mean, it must be a jigsaw puzzle, too, to figure out where to put everything, right?
That to me is sort of part of what is really fun about it is you get the ability to sort of, you know, one of the things, again, oral history really shows is how all of us only understand things from our own personal perspective. And we're often actually very bad at transforming our perspective into sort of what it means to history. And this was something that actually really came to me when I was doing the 9/11 book. I got access to an incredible trove of oral histories that the 9/11 Memorial and Museum in New York had compiled over the years. And most of the characters in all of these books sort of come and go in a single chapter or even a single quote. And there are very few characters that you sort of follow through the whole arc of a story. For the 9/11 book, one of those people ended up being Richard Eichen. And Richard Eichen was one of the only survivors from above the 90th floor of the North Tower. And he's injured in the initial attack, makes his way all the way down the tower. It takes him a really long time. He's caught in the collapse. He ends up at a hospital in Lower Manhattan and then is sort of terrified of follow-on attacks. And so in a hospital gown, breaks himself out of the hospital, walks across the Brooklyn Bridge, and hitchhikes his way home on a pickup truck in Brooklyn. And there's this photo that someone took that sort of only linked up with him years later, where you see him walking across the Brooklyn Bridge carrying a Snapple, which was sort of his only possession that he had that day. And I actually got to meet Richard at the 9/11 Memorial after the book came out, and he said to me, you know, I can't believe you included my story in the book. And I was like, Richard, I read 2,000 oral histories of people on 9/11, and yours was one of the five, you know, craziest, wildest stories. And he had just never made that leap from sort of what his personal experience represented across the sort of totality of human experience that day. And there was another one from that same book. I'm just thinking of these stories so much this year, or at this time of year every year, where this other office worker in the World Trade Center, you know, caught in the collapse, et cetera, makes it home to New Jersey and then is surprised because it's Tuesday night and it's the team photo night for his like peewee team football team. And he calls someone else on the team and they say, you know, well, obviously the team photo's canceled tonight. And he goes, why? And they're like, buddy, like, the nation was attacked and we're at war. And he just hadn't made that leap yet because he was like, I just had a really bad day at work. It hadn't sort of adjusted to him yet that this was not something that just happened to him and sort of his office in Lower Manhattan. This was something that had happened to the whole country.
You're listening to WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee, WMDX Columbus, Madison, WCFW HD2, W228 EP Chippewa Falls, WFHR Wisconsin Rapids, WISS Oshkosh, WZBU New Holstein, WLAK Amory, WLCX La Crosse, WRCE Richland Center, and WBZH Hayward, a part of the Civic Media Radio Network.
One of the grandest operations in human history. I mean, this is the largest invasion in world history. There are a million Allied combatants on the move across the United Kingdom and the English Channel on June 6, 1944. For almost everyone on D-Day, their entire story takes place on like a stretch of sand about the size of this stage. You know, you talk to these paratroopers, or you listen to these paratroopers, and you know, some of them only ever see one hedge in Normandy for the entire day. Some of them spend the entire day alone. There are these incredible stories of these paratroopers dropped into the Norman hedgerows who spend the entire day without seeing another single Allied soldier and sort of wonder all day, like, did the landings ever happen? Or am I the, like, only person on this side of the English Channel?
That's true of every battle.
Yeah.
You know, the individual sees only what they know.
Yeah.
The best book I ever read on that was actually The Charterhouse of Parma, where they describe the sort of one, you know, individuals and what they see. We could talk all night. We only have a few more minutes, so let me ask you a couple of more personal questions. The first of which is, I grew up in a journalism family. The reason I'm here tonight is because of my father, and you did as well. I'm wondering what sort of, your father was the head of the AP in Vermont, and what was it like? Did you have ink in your blood, and what did your father impart to you?
Yeah, so I'm a third generation journalist.
So am I.
My grandfather, who I'm actually named after, was the drama critic for the New York Herald Tribune in the 30s and 40s, and started out covering cops in Pittsburgh in the 1930s. And then my father spent about 30 years as the head of the Associated Press office in Vermont. My mother is actually a magazine writer and author as well. And I just sort of always grew up interested in journalism and continued to be, in part because it's just like, to me, if you're a nerd and if you're curious, like, there's just no better job. Like, you get to sort of wake up and think about things that you're interested in and then call people and call the smartest possible people on whatever the subject is that you're interested in, and then they'll just talk to you, and they'll sort of explain whatever the thing is that you're interested in.
That's great. One last question. I know that one of the reasons you left Washington, went back to Vermont, was thinking about running for office as lieutenant governor. That didn't happen for various reasons, but the 10 years, I think that they said you had to be a resident for 10 years, and those 10 years are up.
So I'm very happy on the journalism side, in part because I think this is a moment, and this comes back a little bit to where we, I think, started the conversation. This is a moment that requires real clarity. And I think one of the things, I am not a Bob Woodward journalist, you know, talking about Watergate in terms of investigative journalism and, you know, finding the one document that no one has ever found. but I think I have some talent in explanatory journalism and sort of explaining why things are the way that they are. And to me, that's sort of the fun of being able to move back and forth as I do between my writing of history and writing of journalism, in trying to use history to help better explain the story of today.
I'm glad that's your answer. And your explanatory abilities and your clarity is what make you great. So thank you so much, Garrett.
Thank you, David.
You're listening to Civic Media's coverage of Cap Times Idea Fest 2025. We'll be right back with Pat Kreitlow of Mornings of Pat Kreitlow with a recap of the other events of this convention.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Actor Neil McDonough. If you saw his face or if you Google him right now, you'll recognize him. He refuses to kiss another woman on camera. On the one hand, I applaud him for not kissing anyone other than his wife, but she says I don't have a problem with him if he wanted to kiss another woman. As someone who's done it, it doesn't really feel like cheating because there's people in the room. It's very mechanical.
You did write it yourself.
I did write it myself.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
This is Robert Pilot, host of Native Roots Radio. On our show, we talk about Native issues like treaties, protecting Mother Earth, and holding our elected officials accountable. You'll also hear from Turtle Island voices like Arvina Martin, State Representative Heather Keeler, Ruth Anna Buffalo, Dr. Anthony Stately, State Senator Mary Kunish, Robert Lilligren, and Bob Blake. Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
At WFHR, Laura Berg, who is voice talent producer.
The thing about Central Wisconsin is what really matters is that your neighbors are okay and you're okay, no matter what your neighbor is. And if you reach out that hand and get to know them, the whole town's going to be better for it.
You got to take time to listen to people that might be a little different than you, but you can find commonalities if we just listen to one another.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
James Santel joining me. Donald Trump just flat out threatening Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook.
A lot of people apparently, Maggie, in high places in government engaging in mortgage fraud, including Adam Schiff and Letitia James, and now Commissioner Cook as well. The Federal Reserve is created independent of politics, preventing exactly this kind of thing from happening. This is the instability that causes economic crisis.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. This year's Wisconsin state budget included a rather unfortunate cut. The Republican-controlled Budget Committee eliminated funding for the Veterans Housing and Recovery Program that would have kept two facilities in Green Bay and Chippewa Falls open and operational. This state program aims to provide temporary housing, training, and supportive services to military veterans who are experiencing homelessness or are at risk of becoming homeless in order to help them obtain permanent housing. In response to these looming closures, Democrats representing parts of Green Bay and Chippewa Falls introduced legislation in August to keep these facilities open. But Republican legislative leadership has not even allowed a public hearing on the bill, and the clock is ticking. Without these funds, these facilities are set to close by September 30th of this year. Republicans need to come to the table and step up to support our veterans now before it's too late.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. If you're looking for honest talk, real stories, and straight-up news that matters to you, tune in to The Rick Smith Show. We're digging into the issues that affect your job, your family, your future. Join me weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network, because your voice deserves to be heard. That's The Rick Smith Show, heard weeknights at 9 right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to Civic Media coverage of Cap Times Idea Fest. I'm Pat Kreitlow, founding editor of Up North News, host of Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9 a.m. on many of these Civic Media stations. Nice to have you along as we engage in a little intermission chatter ahead of the next portion of Idea Fest, one that a lot of folks, and I do mean folks, are waiting for, because that, of course, signifies Governor Tony Evers will be coming on just about 15 minutes from now or so, along with Dave Moranis. The conversation with the governor will wrap up Wednesday's third day of activity, but there's still plenty more to come for Idea Fest. The ninth annual Thought Festival kicked off on Monday afternoon with a discussion of the effects of artificial intelligence. And it just rolled on from there with all kinds of speakers. If you've missed some of them already, I'm sure there'll be plenty of opportunity to read about them in the Cap Times and elsewhere. There was a good discussion on Trump and gerrymandering and the rule of law, a one-on-one with Maureen Dowd, ways to keep Dane County's lakes clean, high-quality apprenticeships, addressing workforce needs in Wisconsin and beyond. There's a Wisconsin sportscast there with Tony Granato. There was Norm Eisen and Jennifer Rubin with a panel called The Contrarians. And there was a one-on-one with Stacey Abrams that we'll talk about more in just a bit. And then, of course, earlier today, the schedule called for helping you navigate your health care and also breakthroughs to cures on immunotherapy, all leading up to the conversation you just heard, Doomsday Scenarios, a conversation with Garrett Graff, which was a very fascinating conversation. You understand why his blog is called Doomsday Scenario. The former editor of Politico magazine and Washingtonian magazine keeps a pretty strict account of the Trump administration's attacks on democracy all these years. In his most recent post entitled America Tips into Fascism, he writes, "I think many Americans wrongly believe that there would be one clear, unambiguous moment when we go from democracy to authoritarianism. Instead, this is exactly how it happens. What we're seeing right now, a blurring here, a norm destroyed there, a presidential dictate unchallenged, and then you wake up one morning and our country is suddenly different." A lot of good points that he made. He talked about how federal law enforcement, by and large, is being brought to a stop. We're talking counterintelligence, we're talking cybercrime, espionage, domestic terrorism, human smuggling, white-collar crime, a halt to hiring new law enforcement officers in all these agencies, all in service to an agency called ICE that is undergoing explosive growth, all to enact a mass deportation strategy, making it much more of a priority to seize Maria in housekeeping than literal drug cartels or Wall Street Ponzi schemes. Or as Graff put it tonight, it's an amazing time to be a criminal in the United States. And Dave Moranis returned with, or the White House. Graff said, this administration is torching the moral legitimacy of what law enforcement has built up in America. All right, what we'll do now is listen to, because again, it's still radio. Let's listen to some of what Stacey Abrams had to say. And she was talking to Maggie Dawn. Stacey Abrams is a Democratic political strategist, a former Georgia legislator. She twice ran for governor in Georgia. She's a tireless voting rights advocate. Abrams founded the Fair Fight Organization. She's also written 17 books. As Cap Times writer Becky Jacobs put it in her story, mere minutes after appearing on stage Tuesday, Stacey Abrams quickly dissected the differences between a democracy and authoritarianism and outlined what she views as the 10 steps to autocracy. She talked about it Tuesday on the Maggie Dawn Show. Here is a 7-minute clip from that conversation.
We've got Leader Stacey Abrams with us this afternoon to close out this show. We're so glad that you are all with us. Right before the break, we were talking about in these 10 steps to autocracy and authoritarianism, step 3 is weaken competing powers. This has been part of the Republican playbook when it comes to voting access and voting rights for 30 years. It has sort of reached fever pitch at this moment. And you have one of your passions, if I can say, has been voting rights and access to the voting booth. What should all people, regardless of party preference, be concerned about the particular ways that the MAGA regime has been eroding both trust and faith in election processes, but almost as importantly, if not more importantly, access, the actual franchise, the access to the voting booth and the right to vote itself?
So step 3, you weaken competing powers. And step 10, you try to ensure that there are no future elections of import. So we have to remember that Russia has an election every few years, but we always know who's going to win. So they don't eliminate voting. They eliminate the power of the vote. And Republicans have been assiduously attacking the power of the vote for the last 30 years. Wisconsin was ground zero. When Wisconsin passed its voter ID law in 2014, you all faced a Supreme Court case where a Black woman was denied the right to vote because her ID did not come with an original birth certificate, but because she was born during the Jim Crow era, she was denied a compliant birth certificate. So when we hear the language of, oh, voter ID, no one disagrees that you should have ID. Everyone aggressively believes that you should have ID. The question is, what type of ID? What are the requirements for that ID? That's what's been weaponized. You talked about the specter of voter fraud, which is a complete and utter myth. There is no voter fraud. It is more likely that you will be struck by lightning, because fraud means intent to pretend to do. I mean, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but put it this way. You are more likely to get struck by lightning than someone is to commit voter fraud in this country. We have an issue with voter participation, not voter fraud. But the larger narrative that we have to understand is that they do not want people to participate in elections. And if they do, they want to make it so difficult that it seems nearly impossible for it to matter. And the way I talk about voter suppression is, can you register and stay on the rolls? Can you cast a ballot? And does that ballot get counted? But what they're also the machinery they are also manipulating is what we're watching happen in Texas and now in Missouri, right? What they are trying to do in other states, which is they're trying to redraw the lines in the middle of the process so that they can't lose anymore. That's the voter manipulation that we need to watch. But we also have to recognize they're also trying to defund election security. They're trying to blackmail local governments. And so our responsibility is to demand access, not just to the ballot, but to the power of the vote. That when we vote for someone, that person should be the person who's actually elected to hold power.
Not just the vote itself, but the power of the vote, the import of the vote, because it stands for how we hold government accountable. Without the power behind the vote, I understand why people have felt disengaged. Absolutely. When that system works, it makes you feel disengaged. And that is its primary objective. So you stay home and nothing matters anymore. I want to briefly pivot with the time that we've got left. One of the Donald Trump sort of brand indicators is that he specifically targets individuals by name. He loves the nicknames. We can call him Little Hand Don, you know, the Orange King, right? All of it. But he loves to give everybody nicknames, and he loves to attack individuals and to bring the power of the MAGA regime mob down on individuals. And in fact, in his pseudo State of the Union address after being sworn into office this very year, he name-checked Leader Abrams. Let's take a listen.
$1.9 billion to recently created decarbonization of homes committee, headed up, and we know she's involved. Just at the last moment, the money was passed over by a woman named Stacey Abrams. Have you ever heard of her?
I'll just say this, Leader Abrams, when the entire Republican caucus of the U.S. Congress boos, that is a huge personal accomplishment. So I'll say congratulations to you.
But this targeting of individuals, whether it's Mark Elias, the law firm he used to work for, going after Judge Dugan with a criminal prosecution, the selective prosecution of an LGBTQIA Lambda lawyer in Alabama. This individual intimidation is designed for a broader purpose. What is it?
So this is a combination of step 7 and step 8. So you scapegoat the marginalized, you scapegoat communities of color, you scapegoat women, you scapegoat the LGBTQIA plus community. You go after communities using DEI, which is why you watch this president and this administration and this party attack diversity, equity, and inclusion, because they are terrified that it actually works. And then you connect that to step 8, which is the civil society that protects all of us, the lawyers who fight for us, the universities who teach us, the philanthropies that invest in us, the protesters who speak up for us. But here's the thing. If you are the average white guy in Wisconsin who's trying to figure out why does DEI matter to you, I would point out that the very first act of DEI in this country was the Revolutionary War, when we decided that you didn't have to be a land-holding man, white man in this country to have purpose and meaning and a vote. We fought an entire war to guarantee that white men of every economic class could participate fully in this country. And from that, we grew the rest of DEI. And it has taken us 250 years, but it is in our DNA that diversity, equity, and inclusion be who we are, because it started with making sure that white men of every stripe had access to what they needed, and the rest of us simply want to be a part of it as well. This is not about taking from one to give to the other. It is about expanding access to opportunity, because we all deserve access to the American dream. And if we believe in DEI, then we are patriots. And if we don't, then we are denying who we are as a nation, and we are on the wrong track.
Because all of us deserve the opportunity to be successful in this country.
That is Stacey Abrams on the Maggie Dawn Show yesterday. Now, coming up, you're going to hear Dave Moranis interview Tony Evers. The interesting part here is that Dave Moranis has deep Madison roots, according to Paul Fanlon. He's interviewed over 40 prominent figures at Cap Times Idea Fest since it began in 2017, but apparently Moranis has never met Tony Evers. Going to be a very interesting conversation coming up from Cap Times Idea Fest. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Catch me 6 a.m. tomorrow across the Civic Media Radio Network. The conversation with Governor Tony Evers is coming up next.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Why is cookie dough in everything now? It was fun when you were a kid and actually ate the cookie dough. But in ice cream, it's just a weird, it's like an interruption for the gorgeous texture that is cold cream ice cream. And then, oh, and here's this uncooked egg and whatever it is. There's a fudge ribbon swirl. Awesome. Vanilla ice cream. Great. Peanut butter cups. Great. Nuts. Awesome. Cookie dough. Barf.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
Indy Duttagupta, he is with the Center for Law and Social Policy.
The Trump administration's agenda is reducing economic growth. The programs that they're proposing cutting, like Medicaid and SNAP, especially for kids, actually more than pay for themselves. So we are really looking at a tough long-term economic outlook entirely created by the current policymakers.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show at its new time, weekdays 4 till 6 p.m. The Todd Albaugh Show.
Mr. Pat Kreitlow joins us from Lake Wissota.
Everything that I know about high culture, everything I know about opera, for example, comes from Bugs Bunny cartoon. The kids are missing out these days. They got Bluey and all of that.
Well, now it's all like real.
We had coyotes falling off of cliffs. Come on.
Exactly. And now it's all this educational crap.
We really have just become the two old men rocking on the porch talking about days gone by.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app.
Aho, this is Robert Pilot of Native Roots Radio. On our show, we share stories from Turtle Island highlighting the people and issues shaping our communities. From protecting water to treaty rights and preserving languages and traditions, we cover it all. Hear voices like Arvina Martin of Emerge Wisconsin, Dr. Stately, Robert Lilligren, and more. Because Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
You are listening to the Civic Media coverage of the Cap Times Idea Fest 2025. We go now back to Memorial Union, where they're preparing for Tony Evers, our governor, to speak on his decision not to run next year for governor.
Hello again, everybody. Well, I think the next hour is going to be absolutely a fascinating conversation, and I'm glad you're here. I've been excited about this one. Welcome again to our 9th annual Cap Times Idea Fest. I do want to take a moment to thank our sponsors who make this possible, in addition to all of you for participating with your ticket purchases. And our big three sponsors this year are Epic, Exact Sciences, and UW Health, the Carbone Cancer Center. Please, give them a hand. I really thought that due to the Carbone's session that preceded Garrett Graff was wonderful, and I appreciate so many of you for being here. It was terrific. Thanks to our other sponsors, Madison Gas and Electric, the Ascendium Education Group, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the University Research Park, the Century House, Penzi Spices, the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, the Madison Community Foundation, Cargo Coffee, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the Forward Theater Company, Leopold's Books, Bar, Cafe, and Madison College. Thank you. That'd be great if you could give them a hand. I appreciate it. Our partners here are Hinckley Productions, Civic Media, Wisconsin Public Radio, Wisconsin State Journal, and Madison.com. Appreciate David Marinus, who's doing double duty tonight. He's the moderator on back-to-back sessions, so thank you, David. It is indeed my honor to welcome Wisconsin's 46th governor to our stage tonight. Tony Evers has spent 50 years in public service as an educator and as our governor. Those of you who follow my columns might know I've interviewed the governor many times, beginning in 2018 with his first gubernatorial campaign. And I've written many times how I think he has been underestimated, that he is one of the most authentic and humble leaders I've encountered in 45 years of writing about politics in the state. In 2019, the first time I sat down with him in his spacious and ornate office in the Capitol's East Wing, I commented that the last time we talked was across the street in his cramped campaign office storage room surrounded by a mountain of boxes. He said, "Paul," he told me, "if it would make you more comfortable, we can bring in some boxes." Please welcome Governor Evers and David Marinus.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. I have to open my Mountain Dew here.
Diet Mountain Dew. He asked you if it was okay if he brought it out on stage.
It's bad for you. Sorry.
Governor Evers, it's a pleasure for me to meet you tonight for the first time ever. I'm sure that hundreds of folks in the audience have gotten to know you better than I, although I follow you from afar with great interest in rooting for you. And I also discovered tonight that probably the best thing that Governor Evers and I have in common is that we married our high school sweethearts and we're both still married.
Yes, how about that? 53 years. Yep.
So you've been standing up to regressive and repressive Republicans for quite a while. I thought that maybe you should get Reggie White's old title as Minister of Defense.
I know. He's got a few pounds and a few more inches than I do. So I am who I am.
But you've had many great moments, but in my opinion, your finest hour was months ago when you stood up to Tom Homan with your I Am Not Afraid speech about them threatening to arrest you. Can you take us through how you found out about it, how you decided to give that speech, and the whole ambiance of that day?
Yeah, I actually thought, if I remember correctly, I just saw him talk about me on TV, CNN, MSNBC, and I thought, well, you jackass. who do you think you are saying that they're going to arrest me or whatever it was? It was just ridiculous. And it's that kind of personal politics that makes people sick of politics. It's when it's personal, especially, you know, it's one thing to say I disagree with you. It's another thing to say I'm going to throw you in jail. I mean, there's a difference there.
Yep.
And that sort of approach, and I've seen him on TV subsequent to that, and it's pretty much that's who he is, and that's somebody that the president obviously has great love for, and so that's the way the administration is operating. That said, have at it. Throw a 73-year-old man into prison. See if it's going to make any difference.
And why did you decide to give the speech for the whole state to hear?
Yeah, I think it was the next day or the day after. Yeah. I mean, we thought about it and we thought, I have to respond, especially when somebody's kind of threatening you in that fashion. And it's not that I really thought that. He would start shaking in his boots, thinking, God, I got to stop doing that. But at least it calls out bad behavior. And so at minimum, we did that.
And it's standing up to a bully, which usually they don't know how to react to that when somebody does stand up to them. But that was back in May, and it's only gotten worse since then in so many ways.
Yeah.
And at that point, as I remember it, he was saying that they would throw you in jail because you wanted to just do legal things to let state agencies know how they should respond.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you took it to today and they went into Milwaukee, what would you do?
Well, I'd do everything I could to stop them. I mean, there are probably things that I don't have authority to do, but at the end of the day, the issue of the National Guard is an issue that is a no-brainer. I'm head of the National Guard in Wisconsin. Great group of men and women that train. They go across the world to support our troops elsewhere. But they are not trained as police officers. And so you see what they're doing in Washington, D.C. It's all, you know, taking care of the lawn and putting mulch out here and there. And wearing a uniform. I guess that is some way to scare the living daylights out of people. But the National Guard are not police officers. And so that's my, we would do everything we can to stop that from happening.
Everything they can is a little general. Do you have specific plans that you weren't talking about?
I'm not going to be able to address that at this time.
But you do have have a plan. Yes. Okay. We'll let somebody answer.
Is that Holloman or whatever? No.
They're coming after you right now.
Is he here? I doubt it.
I compared you to Reggie White, but it's more apt to compare you perhaps to Presidents Clinton and Biden and Obama, who had to play defense, especially in the final years of their terms, where you've had to do it pretty much the whole time.
Yeah.
We'll get to this later, but it's kind of ironic that you've survived that brilliantly over two terms, and then some future Democratic governor might not have to do that again, right?
If
gerrymandering is changed.
It's my gift. It's my gift to the world. No, but what it did, I mean, it wasn't exactly a landslide win the first time around or the second time around, but first time it was just a little over 1%. But I was a Democrat, and I won the seat, and the legislature was almost completely red, certainly of politics. And I think it showed Wisconsin that there's something wrong with the maps here in the state. We talked about it a lot for years. I'm sure most of the people out here talked about it a lot. And I'm not saying this is a great Tony thing, but the fact of the matter is that I won, beat an incumbent, pretty powerful incumbent that had done lots of important things, most of them negative, and I won that race. And the legislature made no difference because it was all red. And I think that put us in a much better place to change maps subsequent to that. And that was a huge deal for us at the state of Wisconsin. Huge.
Yes. It put everything in a better place except for you as governor, in a sense.
Yeah, but
so did you develop a strategy of how to deal with this Republican legislature over the two terms?
Over two terms, yes, yeah. Because they understood that after we had fair maps that we have to work with this guy, and we have to, if we want to accomplish some things, we have to maybe compromise. That's their point of view. And we did that with the last budget and a lot of other things. But the one thing that was good is that the governor has some pretty powerful ways to we can veto all sorts of things, and we did, and we were able to, because of the Senate, we were able to make sure that, or the Senate or the Assembly, that they didn't have any supermajority, and that was critical. So. Horrible things, we stopped. Simple, you know, there's a whole bunch of them, but a horrible bunch of them. Yeah.
What would you say was the most important thing that you stopped that really changed this?
Well, they wanted to change the maps to make it even worse. And, you know, that would put us out for another 100 years. And so there's just no way. So we vetoed several bills that had to do with that.
Well, let's go back to the end, your decision not to run for a third term. I've done some reporting on this, and I know there were several factors, but the one that struck me, because I'm a writer, would place you out in the middle of Lake Mendota on a pedal boat with your wife alone.
Yeah.
Thinking about that.
Yeah.
And how did that influence your decision?
Of course. It was hard. I love this job. a lot of people in this room, I hope at least 51% of the people in this room voted for me. And
I would say a lot more than that.
But, just kidding. And I love the job. And I can say this with all honesty. I learn something new every day. And that's important to me in a whole bunch of ways, but I think it makes me a better governor. And in addition, I had a chance to kind of set my days and how I operate. And I made it very clear right from the beginning that if I was going to represent the people of Wisconsin, I needed to be in Wisconsin. And instead of being in the Capitol a lot, I would say out of a 5-day week or 6-day week or 7-day week, I was out of the Capitol 4 or 5 days. And that makes a whole difference. You know, visiting schools, visiting businesses, visiting nonprofits, you name it, going into small towns and going to every single small town on, or every single main street business in the various places in the state. I learned something every time I'd done that. And that's what made me, I think, made me successful as a governor. I don't talk about myself in those ways too often, but I guess I can now that I'm leaving the office. But that was really important to me, and I forgot your original question. I went too far.
Well, it wasn't about that, but it was about deciding not to run.
Yes.
And I really want you to be out on Lake Mendota on that pedal boat making the decision.
So those are all the good things. And I could have said, yeah, I can do this another year or another 4 years. But when it came down to it, it was about kids and grandkids and Kathy. And we were several times out in the middle of the lake talking about this. And, you know, now when we go out in the middle of the lake, we think, oh, my God, we got to buy a house. We got to buy 2 cars. What are we going to do with all these clothes that I'm no longer going to need? So the conversations have changed a bit. But, it was all about kids, grandkids. I have 9 grandkids. We have 3 children. And God knows how many we're going to have great-grandchildren down the road. And 50 years in state service or local government service, it was time. And so it was a really hard decision to make, but no regrets.
Was that going out 4 or 5 times a week, being around people around you all the time, is that a double-edged sword? Did you also want more privacy than you were allotted as governor, or did you thrive off that?
No, it was great. I have met so many people, made so many friends, and you know, we spent a lot of time, or I spent a lot of time up north, and northern Wisconsin is a pretty red area. But when it comes down to it, those merchants on a 5,000 city population, those people that are doing the good work, whether it's on a farm, whether it's in small towns, they see me as a good person, as somebody that's actually helping them.
Yep. You're 73 years old. Age can be a factor in politics. I'm not accusing you in any way of slipping, except for one thing, which I might have to take back after I say it, but that was your performance announcing the vote at the Democratic Convention.
We don't want to talk about that.
You got me going here.
You know,
what happened there?
It was the damnedest thing. I had it all. Somebody gave me a script that I didn't particularly like, and so I was trying to do things on the fly, and that obviously didn't work. But I also, the person, I can't think of his name now, that was on the other side that was asking me the questions is from Wisconsin, and I wanted to talk to him directly. So I was trying to talk to him when I was talking to thousands of people.
Millions of people.
Yeah, that was a mistake. That was a mistake. But It was a great convention, obviously. That was a kind of a major screw up, but I got over it. And I think most people did too. But the end of the day is a great convention. We had a good candidate, and unfortunately, she didn't win. That was sad.
Well, my only thought when I was watching you on television is, why isn't he wearing a cheese head? Ben Winkler had one on. Did you decide that that wouldn't be appropriate?
I have a bigger head.
Oh, come on.
No kidding. I was going to say something else. No kidding. There wasn't a cheese hat.
That fits your head?
That would fit my head.
You have a bigger head than Ben Winkler.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. I tried on a couple, and I said, these don't fit, and it's going to fall off. That would have made things worse. I mean, could you imagine having a cheese head fall off, forgetting your lines, and say, okay, 55-1 or whatever it was. Yeah.
When Bill Clinton screwed up at a convention, he went and played the saxophone afterwards to make up for it.
Yeah.
You didn't have to do that, though.
Yeah, I never played the saxophone, and I played cornet in junior high school, and when I went to the high school, the music teacher said, don't play anything anymore. So I never had the opportunity to be in a marching band.
I presume... I think safely that you're not going to endorse in the gubernatorial primary.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
I'm curious about sort of the role of governor and lieutenant governor to the extent you can talk about it. I know that historically sometimes those two politicians are not even that close. Mm-hmm. What was your relationship like with Sarah Rodriguez, and what did you make of her?
Yeah, they run separately in the primaries, and she had a really strong opponent, and she won quite handily. And so I was really impressed with that. You know, it wasn't, it's always interesting because you don't select the person that's lieutenant governor.
In some, many states you do. But
yeah, right. But she ran a good race, and obviously she's a really smart person, and does a great job around the issues of health and so on. The working relationship is no different. Mandela Barnes was with me for a couple of years, and he did a good job also. But it's really two separate. They, you know, they pinch hit for me when I can't make things, but at the end of the day, both Mandela and Sarah pretty much can do what they want to do that they feel is important. They're big adults. They can handle that.
So, and pardon my ignorance on this, but how would you compare it with a president and a vice president? In other words, you don't really instruct the lieutenant governor on what assignments you'd like them to carry?
They pinch hit occasionally, but I don't want to make this sound wrong, but it's not a tightly run machine there. And looking back on other governors, it's never been it's never much different in Wisconsin. It's two people that were selected separately and then put together. I got along with both. They both had strengths and tried to build on those strengths.
One of your last acts was maybe your coolest, which is adding the 400-year language into the education funding bill.
Yeah.
How did that come about? How did you think of it? And will it have any impact beyond being symbolic?
Well, 400 years, that's a long time. It is significant, and it'll take some doing for the for that to change. I mean, there'd have to be a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, and probably could change that law. But the good news is we have some really good people. I want to say that I worked real hard. I looked at every line in a budget bill that big. We have people that actually that is their job, is to see where we can use our veto, and that's one of the things that they came up with, and it was a damn good one.
So again, excuse my ignorance on this part of the state government, but that language was added into a veto as opposed to just the budget itself.
Correct. And we crossed off things off.
Line veto.
Lines and numbers and things like that, and voila.
And someone said, let's add 400 years to this thing, and you
said, great. There were some numbers in there. I can't remember, 24
something.
Yeah, 2040 to whatever, and you cross out a few things, and voila, you got 400.
So if that was one of the happiest moments, pulling that one off, what was your darkest moment as governor, would you say?
Oh, there haven't been many, to be honest. I think the most important thing we've done is develop fair maps. Now we have to spend some time making sure that we have a process, an independent process, to do it again when we do this at the end of the decade. And I think we will. I think we can get that done. There were no times that I felt morose about anything. You know, there were things that, like this last time around, I'm an educator. I make sure that we do the best we can for our K-12 system and our our higher education folks. And we just couldn't move the needle as far as we needed. We made some huge progress, but not enough. And so things like that are not the greatest outcomes, but at the end of the day, there wasn't anything significant. I mean, obviously, during the pandemic, we did some things that you hated to influence and make people maybe do some things that they didn't want to do, like stay at home, wear a mask, that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, those are the right things to do. We knew that we were making some people angry, and they weren't going to participate in making sure everybody stayed healthy. But at the end of the day, I don't have any moment that I thought this job really sucks or anything like that. No.
You're listening to WAUK Jackson, Milwaukee, WMDX Columbus, Madison, WCFW HD2, W228 EP Chippewa Falls, WFHR Wisconsin Rapids, WISS Oshkosh, WZBU New Holstein, WLAK Amory, WLCX La Crosse, WRCE Richland Center, and WBZH Hayward, a part of the Civic Media Radio Network.
The answer is yes and no. We have a group of Republicans in the legislature that are as strongly right wing as anybody that's in Washington, D.C. We've got Congress people from Wisconsin that fall into that category. But the good news is, and I don't want to overstate this, but when we developed the fair maps, we knew that we had opportunities to change that behavior a little bit, and we did. We had a budget that was passed. I know there were some things that we didn't get, but we did get quite a few things that I think are very helpful for our state, including in education, and including, whether our infrastructure is strong, a number of things like that that we did get. And we compromised on some things. And when we compromised, they got some things. Frankly, we got some things that we would never have gotten. And so this system works. It doesn't work perfectly, but I feel much better today than I did when it was things were difficult in the legislature.
Speaking of fair maps, another theme that's come out in the last few days at the Idea Fest has to deal with how you respond to Republican unfairness in terms of gerrymandering.
Oh my God.
And first of all, do you know Governor Newsom? I mean, I'm sure you've met him. And what do you think about what he's trying to do out there in your response?
I mean, I hate to sound like I haven't decided, but I spent a good part of my life saying fair maps are really important. We have to get it. We have to make sure that we get this in Wisconsin. We're successful. And, you know, we are a purple state, whether we like purpleness as a color. It is what it is. And I don't see any race for governor to be somebody who's going to win by 5% or 10%. That's just not going to happen. But what was the question again?
This is not the Democratic National Convention.
Yeah, I know. But I was headed down the road.
No, it's about what Governor Newsom is doing in California.
Yes. And the problem is I find it disgusting that Trump calls up the people in Texas and says, "Hey, I need 5 more seats." And then we're put in Democratic governors are put in the position of doing something equally horrible, frankly. You know, there should be a process that people follow, not like when the president says jump, you jump. And then, so I'm glad I'm not in that position that Newsom is, that he can do it. He's got a whole bunch of Democrats there.